Though we're a bit early, are the parties ready to proceed in the civil commitment, Matthew David Feeney?
The county is here.
Okay. Oh, very good. And I'll note for the record, the file A190926, and feel free to have a seat. Once everybody's ready, we'll ask appellant to proceed. Of course, each party will have 15 minutes and 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant. We do ask when you approach the podium to identify yourself for the record. Keep an eye on the time. Hopefully the clock there is working in the lights so we can be fair to both parties. And as soon as appellant's ready to proceed, you may.
May it please the court, Paul Eng on behalf of Matthew Feeney. With me is Tyler Bliss. This case concerns an immutable principle in law, and it is that the disposition of a sentence of a defendant is the final decision of the court, not anybody else's. And the question we have here is, who gets to decide when Mr. Feeney serves his time in Massachusetts? Is it the judge who imposed a consecutive term of 5 years to his 109 months in Washington County? Or is it by fiat, a county attorney's office, or an assistant county attorney who can file a petition for commitment at any time for any cause that they deem fit? The law has never been that the judiciary is powerless to review a decision of a county attorney involving a case of this magnitude. It's never been that way, nor should it ever be. So we're asking the court to engage in its supervisory power in a separation of powers and make a determination here under the various statutes, case law, and the full faith and credit clause to adhere to the wishes of a Boston judge as opposed to the arbitrary timing of the county attorney's office here. This is a fascinating case. It's one of first impression. We've not had a decision from the court involving...
When you say arbitrary timing of the county attorney, you're referring to the county attorney's decision to petition for commitment?
Yes, we believe it's arbitrary. What's
the language in the statute that would prevent a county attorney from making a determination of probable cause?
Well, they can make the determination. The issue of the timing of the determination is something that the case law and the statutes suggest is premature here.
What is the language in the statute that that suggests that the county attorney's action is premature?
Well, there is no language in the statute that governs prematurity. There's this case, of course, Nielsen, that says there's
I thought you mentioned there was language in the statute. I thought you said the statute.
There is language implies. In other statutes, companion statutes, involving the commitment process that suggests this is premature.
What's the clearest language in any statute that would allow us to hold as a matter of law that the county attorney is precluded from making the probable cause determination when the county attorney did in this case?
Well, the clearest language appears in two places. There's 253D22, which suggests the proper order of a case like this, and the proper order is to ensure that the defendant serves his time first and then the commitment follows thereafter. The secondary statute is 24405, which holds that the proper order of judging a commitment process like this is for a reference to occur 12 months before the end of the defendant's term, and at that point a referral is made. So the legislature is...
At least 12 months.
At least 12 months.
So why would the language of at least 12 months preclude the action from occurring longer for a period that's longer than 12 months?
Well, it probably wouldn't, but in this case, they were within the 12 months. They came with 4 months before he was released. So, I mean, the facts of this don't speak to the 12 months. But then if you dig further, dive further into the process here, and this is really a process case on how we should proceed with a possibility of lifetime commitment for Mr. Feeney in the right and fair way. And then if you look at the regulations that are underneath or have been evolved to satisfy 244.05, and those are 205.200, they suggest that whether or not the defendant is in state custody or foreign custody or federal custody, the same timing sequence should be made, that is, at least 12 months before the end of release. So the way we read the regulations, which are helpful, is that the timing of this petition should be made when he's almost completed with all his prison time.
You've repeatedly said that what the statute suggests, but if we're going to determine as a matter of law that the county attorney was precluded from petitioning and making the probable cause determination, don't we need more than just a suggestion in the statute or an inference?
There are a couple other avenues for, as a matter of law, to determine this is premature. As a matter of law, under the extradition statutes, if Mr. Feeney, as he did, waived his extradition rights from Minnesota to Boston or the Massachusetts, that confers jurisdiction over him in Massachusetts just by the mere fact of the waiver. And then you have the extradition statutes which require him to be sent there.
Exclusive jurisdiction or concurrent jurisdiction?
Well, I think it, you know, this is a...
Can you just wait for a second until...
Thank you.
We've taken a little bit of time off of your...
That's okay. Well, I mean, you know, what's fascinating about this case, Judge, is that there are competing statutes as to what we should be doing. And so there is a statute that governs commitments. There's a statute that governs extradition. There are cases that say do your prison time first and then be committed. And then there are the constitutional claims.
I thought you were suggesting exclusive jurisdiction in Massachusetts. And I, based upon, I'm not sure I agree with you on the where we are in the record as far as extradition goes, but crediting your factual or procedural understanding, I'm at a loss for how we get to the conclusion that's implied in your argument, which is that Massachusetts has exclusive jurisdiction based upon extradition proceedings.
Well, I think they have a priority jurisdiction because of the extradition statutes that requires him to be transferred within 30 days. And then we have a constitutional claim that buttresses that, called full faith and credit, which is has been adopted in the Phillips decision, that under the full faith and credit clause, we as Minnesotans and in the judiciary of Minnesota accept the Massachusetts judgment and we will adhere to it and make sure it's embraced and fulfilled.
Is it true, Mr. Ng, just to follow up on that point, and you may have more answer to Judge Ross's question after that, there is no extradition sought at this point?
Well, the reason is that they filed, there are two points to that, if I may. There's a letter in the file that say they want him back. But before the extradition became ripe, before July 1st, 2009, the county filed its petition and an order keeping him. And so there's a competing order, if you will, between Washington County and the Massachusetts preference that he be given consecutive time. I mean, the no judge in Massachusetts, well, I don't know if no judge, but it would be difficult to anticipate the court in Massachusetts realizing that the sentence that he imposed, the judge imposed, would be delayed. I mean, there's no way to anticipate that. But it is being delayed, and it's wrongly being delayed.
Does your client have standing to raise that issue if there's no formal extradition at this point seeking? In other words, there's no action upon which a judge could exercise comity in this situation.
If they withdraw their petition or is dismissed or held in abeyance or dismissed without prejudice to be brought again, then Massachusetts will get him. I mean, that letter in the file from the Department of Corrections saying, we want you, we'll get you. And we want you the minute you're done with Minnesota's term. So whether or not it's a formal extradition order, it's certainly their preference as to what should happen here. And the letter, you'll note, doesn't say, well, after you're done with commitment proceedings and after you're done with the appellate process and after you're done with the review hearing in a three-judge panel going on and on and on, then we'll get them. That's not what the letter says. You know, the real problem here.
How do we know what Massachusetts' position is on the issues that you're raising on appeal?
Well, we have the position is the letter that is the best evidence that you have that they want them back.
Is there anything in our rules that would have prohibited their joining this appeal if the state of Massachusetts agreed with your position to argue on behalf of the state of Massachusetts?
I suppose they could file a motion to join the appeal. I must be remiss in not asking them. I didn't ask them to, but I suppose they could under your rules. Yeah. Here's the problem, though.
What do we make of the fact that they didn't?
Well, I don't think you can make a fact one way or another that they didn't. I mean, they're not here. This kind of reminds me of the case we had.
But aren't you asking
not
us
here,
to?
You know?
Aren't you essentially asking us to assume that all of the implications that you're asking us to draw from their letter would necessarily mean that they agree with your position as to the state of Massachusetts' interest in timing?
Well, it's hard to read their letter any other way. I mean, we want him back. The whole letter was caused by Mr. Feeney early on before the commitment process asking whether can I do my time here? Can I do it in Minnesota? And they said, no, we want you. So the intention of Massachusetts is pretty clear. Here's the real problem with the case. It's a due process consideration. Jurisdiction challenges the basis of the reason to hold him, and also whether due process will be fulfilled if he's here. And our problem with Mr. Feeney's case is that he has a high recidivism score. The percentage is up there. So for any judge looking at this case, and I know a couple of you have been on the bench, you say, well, is he a danger? Is he going to do it again? And if he's going to do it again, I got to commit him. And that's the vernacular, if I may simplify it. And so our task is to get that score down. Everything else in the case is static. I mean, his criminal history is static, the victim's testimony and outrage is static and will be repeated at the hearing. But the only way to get that test result or that percentage result is to get treated and to complete treatment, not just to get treated, but to clean. And that's why the Boston piece is so important to us, in that there is a program there. They don't dispute the statute. They don't dispute the cases that we've cited interpreting the program. It's a 36-month max opportunity for him. People are encouraged. Inmates are encouraged to participate in the program.
Mr. Ames,
he can get it done because he's got to do 40 months. Go ahead. Sorry.
I wanted to get back. You mentioned jurisdiction, and part of the point respondent makes is that that was the basis for the interlocutory appeal. And it seems from the arguments you're making, especially on full faith and credit, your client's conceding there's at least concurrent jurisdiction. So Minnesota does have personal jurisdiction over your client as well as Massachusetts.
Well, the law is that there is concurrent jurisdiction, yes, but the basis of the priority of the jurisdiction is what we're challenging here. There's got to be a mechanism for him to challenge the order, the due process order of how a case is processed like this, especially one involving life in prison or the possibility thereof and never getting out. But if I make it the three prongs of this jurisdiction, he was served. But we can challenge the basis of it or the priority of it, and we can challenge whether due process will be adhered to. And that's the second prong of Ivy and all those, the two sentences that are always listed. And the what's really important here is that he can go to Boston and complete a treatment regimen and actually be completed. And once he completes that, the matrix, the statistical matrix, the actuarial matrix that they use in 205-200 will change. And that number will go down. And I have, as his advocate, an obligation to try to actually win his case, of course, but to get the most favorable evidence I can possibly get. And we cite the Beecroft decision, among others, that he has a right to achieve and retain and present favorable evidence. And what the timing of the, they could have brought this 3 years into his Boston sentence, could have done that. And what they've denied him now, or what they're attempting to deny him, and the judge's oral opinion would do this, is his ability to present evidence that he completed treatment. It's huge. It's absolutely huge. And so that's you know, in other cases we've had, well, they can, the timing can be anywhere. The Nielsen's case, you know, there was no prejudice involved. The guy had an indeterminate sentence, but he's there for 4 years. He can complete a protocol. He can present evidence of that. And the danger here, and what we find offensive about the timing of this, is they're depriving him of that chance. And that is the best opportunity he has of ever defending this. This case we need help on this case on the order of things. And one of the reasons we appealed is we need help on how a case should be processed where there's a foreign jurisdiction. And what should happen here is that Mr. Feeney's sentence in Boston should be served first. It's enormously important that it be so, and it's consistent with all the laws and statutes that we have.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Yang. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is James Zuliger, Zuliger. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent respondent Washington County attorney in this matter. Your honors, we're here today on an interlocutory appeal. That in and of itself is significant to the task at hand today. Not everybody gets an interlocutory appeal. Normally appeals come at the end of the proceedings. However, with very few circumstances, very few issues, this court can review midstream during the litigation.
Usually the notion of interlocutory appeal occurs in civil cases where you have at the end a potential for a final decision, and the interlocutory issues are just preliminary. In this case, I'm not sure in this setting, under the statute that allows for an appeal of any order, that the interlocutory appeal restrictions would apply. Can you address the fact that the statute in this case allows for an appeal of any order?
Under 253D, Your Honor?
Yes.
It's my understanding the right to appeal is after the final commitment order, not any order during the process.
Well, is there language in the statute that would say so?
As far as when a litigant can appeal?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I believe it's either referenced in 253D or it's cross-referenced in 253B, which is also the Commitment Act with respect to persons who have a mental illness, that the appellate time starts to accrue as of the issuance of the order as opposed to entry of judgment, and that a party has 60 days. I'm not aware of any thing in the statute, though, that allows a litigant or a party to appeal anything other than a final order. It's my understanding that the basis for appellant's appeal was to challenge jurisdiction, citing the Kastner case, which is cited in both briefs, that stands for the proposition that when a litigant challenges either personal or subject matter jurisdiction or raises an issue of immunity, the court will accept interlocutory review to resolve that issue before allowing the matter to proceed. But that's exclusive, Your Honor. And of course, immunity is not at all raised in this matter. So the only questions before this court is there subject matter jurisdiction before the lower court to hear this matter? And is there personal jurisdiction over Mr. Feeney in this matter? The answer to both questions is unequivocally yes. The Commitment Act, 253D, confers subject matter jurisdiction to the district court. 253D.07, that basically says any time a petition is filed with the district court in the county of financial responsibility or the county in which the patient is present, the court shall hear the matter within 90 days or a maximum of 120 days. So we have statute that confers subject matter jurisdiction, and that doesn't appear to be challenged here. personal jurisdiction, the facts are not in dispute either. In fact, there's a concession. You only need two requirements for the court to obtain personal jurisdiction. Process a service that conforms with due process and the rules of civil procedure and adequate connection to Minnesota. There's no challenge that Mr. Feeney was personally served by a third party in Minnesota on February 8th, 2019 with the petition commencing the commitment proceedings against him in this matter. In fact, I believe there's even a concession in the motion papers that we previously filed to dismiss this matter that this appeal is not about service of process. There's no dispute that there's an adequate connection to Minnesota. Mr. Feeney has been a lifelong resident of Minnesota. He was a resident of Washington County prior to his most recent period of conviction. He was convicted in a Washington County court, and he's still serving a sentence on that conviction. Six of the nine criminal offenses which he was convicted for occurred in Minnesota. So the facts are just overwhelming and unequivocal that there is adequate connection.
Well,
that's all you
need. Let's assume for sake of argument that we disagree with you about the appeal stopping once we've answered whether or not there's subject matter and personal jurisdiction. And how do you respond to Mr. Ang's due process argument that if you were to do commitment hearings and trial after his period of incarceration in Massachusetts, where he had the opportunity to participate in a 36-month determinant period of time treatment program, and assuming also that he successfully completed that, that his recidivism score would go way down if he were to then come back and have a commitment trial?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would be remiss if I simply didn't point out right off the top that has nothing to do with personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction.
I understand that.
And then getting to the merits of that, I am unaware of any case law out there or even the concept that allows for a litigant to ask for an indefinite delay to the proceedings in the cosmic chance that some favorable evidence may come to his or her provision to defend against the action.
When you say proceedings, you're talking about the commitment proceedings.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, let's look at it practically. If there was a due process right to indefinitely postpone an action because there may be favorable evidence that comes into existence, they're not even saying it does exist, but it may come into existence, how could we ever litigate?
Well, I don't think it's an indefinite postponement. He does have a sentence that is a set number of months in Massachusetts. As I understand what you said in your brief, he's served his Minnesota sentence. You want to go forward with the commitment proceeding, but once those proceedings are concluded, before he starts serving his civil commitment in MSOP, he would go to Massachusetts and serve his sentence there and then come back to MSOP. Am I understanding the chronology correctly?
That is correct. It is certainly not our position, has never been our position, that Mr. Feeney is going to avoid his prison time that he owes in Massachusetts. That will happen. The question is there subject matter and personal jurisdiction now to commence those proceedings? Assuming hypothetically in the event that Mr. Feeney is civilly committed, he will not be admitted into the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake. He will go to Massachusetts to serve his sentence, and then once that is completed, he will be taken into custody and brought back and admitted to the secure treatment facility in Massachusetts.
I have a question I want you to address the statutory prematurity argument that Mr. Feeney is asserting, but beforehand, just so I can understand the big picture, what is the state's interest in having the civil commitment proceedings occur before the Massachusetts sentence is served? The argument is that the state is trying to prevent Mr. Feeney from the opportunity to get treatment, which it seems to me is the ultimate objective is to, if he is committable, the objective of the state, presumably is to cure him of any conditions that would make him a sexually dangerous person. So I'm trying to get a sense of what is the state's interest in handling the commitment proceeding before the Massachusetts sentence.
To get to the latter part of the question, we are not preventing treatment, and I will address that in a moment. But to answer your first question, why now? Because he's here now. He's going to be transferred to Massachusetts. He was originally supposed to be transferred as of July 1st.
So your argument is your state's position is just a matter of convenience?
Not just convenience, Your Honor. It's because we did receive a referral from the Department of Corrections approximately 13 or 14 months before his anticipated release, July 1st of 2019. We went to the court to compel records to determine whether there was good cause proceeding, and then the process did play out. We did retain a psychiatrist to screen it for the office, and the psychiatrist came back and screened that Mr. Feeney does meet criteria, and every effort was made to file the petition in more than ample time prior to his transfer to Massachusetts, which was in February. The statute holds that the hearing must be held 90 days following the filing of the petition. It can be extended for good cause for a maximum of 120. It was filed on February 8, 2019. That's more than four and a half months.
So you're saying the statute compels the proceeding to go forward. My question is, going back a step further, I'm just trying to get a sense of, your reading of the statute, I gather, is if once the Department of Corrections begins the process, the county attorney is obligated to make a probable cause determination within the limited statutory period.
Right. We're not necessarily required to file it. There's no as matter of law, but I think there is a legal obligation that if it has been referred, that we will at the very least consider whether it shall be brought. With respect to the timing, it's simply not a matter of convenience, Your Honor. There's no question that we have jurisdiction. The timing is right because he is soon to be leaving the state. Without conceding as such, if we were simply allow him to leave the state, it seems to me that would raise more questions than we do now, whether or not there is standing, whether there is jurisdiction to haul him into court here. And not only that, whether it's simply practical to do so. As counsel for Mr. Feeney has pointed out, this process is typically started over a year prior to the release.
You're suggesting if the state were to acquiesce and yield to Mr. Feeney's desire to serve his sentence in Massachusetts first before the commitment proceeding, that the state of Minnesota may lose its personal jurisdiction to administer or to proceed?
I'm saying that it simply raises more issues.
Right, but is that the issue that you're suggesting that it raises?
Well, as far as part of the county attorney's decision whether to file it now or to wait. However, I would back up, Your Honor.
I'm not sure you've answered my question. Are you suggesting are you saying that was, or that is a concern, an interest of the states to commence the process now to make sure that there's no risk of personal jurisdiction?
That is correct, because Mr. Feeney's attorney, Mr. Ang, even concedes in his argument before you that Mr. Feeney is dangerous. His actuarials, as set forth in the petition in this matter, are quite high. He's in the 99.7th percentile of all sex offenders who were studied who recidivate. I'm not sure if you can get much higher than that. He's dangerous. And we have the opportunity now to do something about it, and quite frankly, the decision was made not to leave it to chance. Whether we could do something in the future.
Is the only difference, I think, by your answer to Judge Ross's question, the state still plans to go back to Massachusetts and get him, assuming there's a commitment, he then finishes his prison sentence and then brings him back here.
We will have to do that, correct.
So isn't it true that, at least with regard to the Department of Corrections policy, generally is to wait until that within that year of the incarceration. The only difference here is the incarceration happens to be Minnesota and Massachusetts. So is there really, and to answer the last point you made, and Mr. Ng raises this point, is there any downside to allowing him to finish his entire incarceration due treatment, and then begin the civil commitment process. The state's not out any. There's no public safety because he will be in custody during that time.
Okay. If you permit me to give two responses to that answer. One is, the first one, and most importantly, that's a prosecutorial discretion to be made by the county attorney's office. The county attorney has no temporal restrictions on when to file the commitment. This court in Nelson, a published decision, unequivocally, unqualifiedly held that to be the case. Now, to get to your question, Your Honor, as to why now, why not wait, it would pose challenges. Whether or not Mr. Feeney would actually be treated, I think, is highly speculative in this case. I don't know if he'll be offered treatment. I know that they cited certain cases from Massachusetts that make reference to it. They cite a DOC policy in Massachusetts stating as such. However, that policy was not made part of the record in the lower court, and I don't even have a copy of it. I tried to Google it, and I was unable to obtain it, so I'm a bit of a disadvantage as to what exactly that policy says. But even assuming arguendo that it says that we shall offer this, that doesn't mean it will actually happen. I've seen it in cases here in Minnesota where an inmate was ordered to do sex offender treatment, or the inmate requested to do sex offender treatment in the DOC, and that simply didn't happen for a variety of reasons, possibly bed space or limited resources. I see that my time is up. I respectfully request that the court affirm the lower court's decision denying their motion to dismiss. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ng, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, there was no answer to the question of why not wait, other than somehow it would be difficult or pose difficulties.
Well,
it
doesn't
pose any difficulties whatsoever.
There was one answer. One answer was that the county attorney has the authority under the statute to begin the process. The separation of powers prevents this court from intervening in the prosecutorial decision of the county attorney, and the statute sets in motion a chain of events from that probable cause determination going forward. I think that was part of the answer.
Well, that was part of his answer, but there is no answer to why he couldn't, or the Washington County, not my friend personally, but why Washington County couldn't start the process 1 year before.
Right. Well, that's
Feeney's release.
That's a shoulda, woulda, coulda. We know that the county attorney did commence the process. Whether it could have waited or didn't is not really a matter before us.
I must disagree with you on that, in all due respects. What we're trying to say here, as best I can, is that there is process due in a case like this, and there are timing sequences that we have in law. And the old adage is, if we follow the right process, we'll get the right result. If we obviate the process or the timing and take shortcuts, we don't necessarily get the result that's fair and equitable. And so the claim is not just statutory, it's full faith and credit, it's due process under Beecroft. It's a plethora of notions that all combine in law to make it difficult for the county to proceed, because in essence, this is fundamentally unfair.
What do you feel is, I mean, you've got a number of theories that you're presenting
I'm trying to see which one would work for you.
Sure. what do you feel is the most compelling and clear under either the statutory language, the exact statutory language, precise statutory language, or specific case holdings? What is the strongest argument to prevent the county from going forward?
Okay. The strongest argument is in 244.05, which says 12 months or more before release, you start the process, which relates to this regulation that doesn't make a distinction between a foreign jurisdiction or our jurisdiction. So if you take the regulation, you take the statute, it says, look, 12 months before you're done with your foreign jurisdiction, we should follow the same process as if you were done here in the state. And so they're relying, they conceded that they got a referral, they're relying on the referral, they did their own independent evaluation.
Now, there is case law that suggests that the county attorney is not it doesn't have to wait for the Department of Corrections to begin the process.
Right. There is, they can make their own independent determination, but it's still a
well, you know, that happened, issue. Didn't that happen here?
That happened here, but it, the issue is whether it's fair and whether it's consistent with due process under the competing statutes. In a way, this case is about a conflict of laws. You got, as I say, you got extradition, you've got the ability to get favorable evidence, and then you get this arbitrary decision. And it's really, you know, to take the position that your questions do, not that you would do this, but I mean, to say that hands off, do whatever you want to. We care not when we cast the wrong verb. We will not interfere with whatever you want to do. And we abdicate any supervisory capacity here over how the case proceeds and the timing of it. It's just something that the law has never permitted. I mean, I just never seen the evisceration of judicial power like this. I mean, the only case they've got, and the one that you're referring to, I believe, is at Nielsen, where there was an indeterminate sentence. It was an opinion that went too far. It's the old adage, decide what's before you, rather than a greater ruling. And Nielsen was a guy that could have gotten out on a parole hearing, so they hurried up and filed a petition. And in this case, you know, there's no indeterminate sentence here in Boston. It's a five-year due four, or due 40 months minimum. And so it's not quite the same thing. And then Nielsen never talked about extradition. It never talked about foreign jurisdictions. It never talked about full faith and credit clause. And so the whole thrust of what I'm trying to do here for Mr. Feeney is to say that there is more involved in the decision than there was in Nielsen, that there has to be. There's equitable considerations for Mr. Feeney that were wholly absent from that case. And I would urge the court to reverse the district court and send him back to Boston. What they're suggesting instead is do it here, send him over, send him back, send him over, send him back. I mean, one stop in Boston would be much better, fairer, equitable, cheaper, and more decent.
Thank you to both counsel. Thank you for your comments today as well as your written comments. We'll take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling. Have a good day.
Thanks.